From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Donald Trump spoke this morning for about 50 minutes at the Conservative Political Action Conference outside Washington, D.C. It was a wide-ranging speech. He promised bigger military spending and to keep up his battle on business regulations. And he spent the first few minutes talking about the media.
A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people. And they are. They are the enemy of the people. Because they have no sources, they just make them up when there are none.
Joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. And Tamara, that's something he's been talking about now for several days. Anything new there in that part of the speech?
Well, he was trying to make a distinction between the media broadly, some of whom he likes, some of whom are good people, and the fake media. And one thing he said shortly after that clip you played is, you know, they shouldn't use run a quote unless they name the source. They should use the names of the people. And he took issue with a Washington Post report about Michael Flynn that had nine unnamed sources. He was critical of that story, though the White House has not disputed it. And the ironic thing about all of this is just this very morning, The Trump administration held a gaggle with reporters with a senior administration official where they insisted that the official not be named.
On a number of topics, he went back to his America First policy. Let's listen.
Global cooperation, dealing with other countries, getting along with other countries is good. It's very important. But there is no such thing as a global anthem, a global currency, or a global flag. This is the United States of America that I'm representing. I'm not representing the globe. I'm representing your country.
Tam, he also hinted that his administration is close to unveiling an update to his executive order that's been halted by the courts. This, of course, was the order he signed in late January that restricted travel for people from seven Muslim-majority countries. Any update on when that might be coming?
The latest we've heard is that we're not going to get that before President Trump delivers his address to a joint session of Congress on Tuesday. So in theory, we won't see it before then. They've been sort of working it out, trying to avoid some of the legal problems that they encountered the first time around and also some of the sort of logistical problems of announcing an order, signing it and putting it into effect immediately as people were in transit.
He also talked about military spending, and this was kind of puzzling because he's been talking about how he wants military spending to be higher, but he went after the sequester as something that has weakened our military, and we remember that it was the Republicans who insisted on those spending cuts in order to raise the debt ceiling.
Yeah, the sequester was this thing that was supposed to be a sword of Damocles that would make it so that Democrats and Republicans would agree on spending cuts. Ultimately, they didn't agree on the spending cuts. And so the sword came down and the sequester has been in place for several years now, making what many believe are arbitrary cuts to the military as well as domestic spending. Now, how the Congress and the president get around that, how they increase spending and raise the debt ceiling and do all of those things that have been a real contentious matter before. That's not clear yet, though the White House says to expect a budget sometime in the next few weeks.
Well, and I have to imagine that some of the people in that room of conservatives were in favor of the sequester when it happened because that was the opposite of what President Obama wanted at the time.
Well, I mean, his budget director was in favor of the sequester.
Right. So, Tam, I have to wonder about a speech like this. Is there something unseemly about a president giving this speech more than a month into his presidency to a group that only represents, you know, the far right of the conservative side of the political aisle?
Well, and, you know, he also did his campaign speech over the last weekend, which was certainly aimed at people who supported him. you know, he's going to give his joint address to his address to a joint session of Congress. I wish we could just call it the State of the Union on Tuesday. That is when we'll be looking, when, you know, voters I've spoken to will be looking for the president to stop talking about the election, stop talking about his amazing victory, and try to speak to all Americans. You know, on election night, he said he wanted to be the president for all Americans.
Right.
But since becoming president, a lot of his focus has still been on sort of like, I won, you lost.
That's NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tamara, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, the United Nations warned this week that some 20 million people in Africa and the Middle East are on the brink of famine. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the food crisis is particularly bad in South Sudan, Nigeria, Somalia, and Yemen.
We had a combination of factors. We have El Nino. We have now different other weather patterns with similar effects. We have a multiplication of conflicts that became particularly dramatic from the point of view of access.
That's particularly true in South Sudan, where the UN declared a famine in areas that have been torn by war. The agency says 100,000 people there are starving, and millions more need help immediately. Rose Ogulla is in the South Sudanese capital of Juba. She's working with the aid group World Vision with their famine response team, and she joins us via Skype. Rose, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
You've been visiting clinics this week in Juba where people are coming in for help. How bad is the food problem where you are?
It's really quite bad because of the huge food insecurity that people are suffering from countrywide. Malnutrition levels have gone up really high, and we're talking about 270,000 children suffering from severe malnutrition. Just yesterday, I went to a health center right here in Juba, the capital, and I met this little girl. Her name is Mary, and she's 14 months old, and she's severely malnourished. She weighs about 6 kilograms, which is about half of what a child her age should weigh.
What kind of help are aid groups able to offer, and is it mostly short-term stopgap measures?
Quite a lot short-term, in some cases just trying mid-term, but mainly short-term. World Vision, for instance, is offering plans to reach about 900,000 food insecure people within this year. We've already reached close to 400,000 in the last 6 months. And we also have programs that are addressing malnutrition among children below the age of 5, because they are really, many of them are really affected. And therefore, we would like to save that generation. Otherwise, we're going to be losing a generation if these children are not supported or are not given the necessary food assistance that they require.
The youngest are the hardest hit. We should say that South Sudan is the newest country in the world. It formed in 2011 after it broke away and declared independence from Sudan. The country's been in a state of war since independence because the president, Salva Kiir, has been fighting with troops loyal to the opposition leader, his former deputy. How much is that conflict behind the famine?
It's contributing quite a bit because when there's conflict, then people get uprooted from their homes. And this has interrupted food production in areas that were considered food baskets for this country. In addition, there's an economic crisis going on in this country. Therefore, even the little food that is available is quite unreachable for most people in this country. And again, due to insecurity, sometimes even humanitarian workers are not able to reach some of the areas where people need assistance.
The South Sudan government seems like it's more focused on bullets than bread. What, if anything, is the government doing to help its people?
What I know is that the humanitarian community here is really crying out to the international community to help the humanitarian workers here do what they need to do, and also calling on the international community to work with the government of South Sudan and to see whether peace can resume in this country.
Are people unable to farm because of the ongoing fighting?
Quite a lot, because if people are uprooted from their homes, we have close to 3.5 million people displaced, some of them internally and others externally in neighboring countries. Therefore, this has disrupted their normal livelihood activities, including farming.
Are aid workers able to access the areas where people are most in need, or is the fighting and the conflict too intense there?
In some cases, we are able to access some of these places. Sometimes we have to disrupt or suspend our activities. For instance, World Vision and other humanitarian workers had to suspend emergency humanitarian assistance in a place called Waushiluk in Upper Nile because there was fierce fighting going on. And it's not just the conflict that raises or brings about access issues. In South Sudan, when it rains, some places become just unreachable, unfortunately. And the rain season is from May to November. Therefore, as we speak now, we have a small window up to May before the rainy season starts. And therefore, we need to reach the people who really, really need assistance before this rainy season starts. And therefore, we're calling on the international community, the donors, to come forward. Just early this week, a humanitarian appeal or an appeal for humanitarian assistance was launched, and $1.6 billion is required to meet the needs of about 5.8 million people in this country.
Rose Ogola is with the famine response team with the aid group World Vision. She's been speaking about the food insecurity problems in South Sudan due to fighting and weather. She's been speaking with us from Juba, South Sudan. Rose, thank you and good luck.
Thank you very much.
And it's been a week of contentious town hall meetings for lawmakers across the country. Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton was shouted down by an angry crowd in Springdale when he was asked about gun laws and a vote last week by Senate Republicans that would expand gun access for the mentally ill.
Why do you want guns in the hands of people adjudicated mentally ill? I'm passionate.
So Diane's talking
Please
about
answer.
A vote last week that we repealed a regulation that infringed upon the rights of law-abiding citizens.
Come on. We're not talking about that.
In Iowa Falls, Senator Chuck Grassley heard from a farmer during his town hall earlier this week.
I'm on Obamacare. If it wasn't for Obamacare, we wouldn't be able to afford insurance. With all due respect, sir, you're the man that talks about the death panel. We're going to create one great big death panel in this country that people can't afford to get insurance. Don't repeal Obamacare. Improve it.
So, how has all this been going over on social media? Femi Oke is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She joins us now. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
And pretty amazing sound bites there. How has this been going over online?
I would say maximum engagement on Twitter, on Facebook, thousands and thousands of conversations happening all over. And also little pockets of conversations, because as the lawmakers go home to their constituencies, they're having those local conversations, which also bleed into the big national political conversation at the same time. So on Facebook, Representative Elise Stefanik from New York, she talked about how aggressive these town hall meetings were becoming. She says it's unfortunate and counterproductive that a small number of activists believe the best way to address the very serious issues facing our country is to hijack and ambush community events for theater.
Which is what we have heard from the Trump administration, that these are paid protesters, that these are all manufactured.
Indeed. There is a group who say outright that we are here to help you organize. It doesn't mean that everybody going to all of these town halls have read up on their guidelines, but the group is called Indivisible. You will find them on Facebook. You will also find them on Twitter under @IndivisibleTeam, and they will give you suggestions about how you can talk to your representative and how to be an activist at the same time.
Meanwhile, Femi, another big issue this week has been federal immigration raids, the new guidelines from the Trump administration. What are some of the things you're seeing shared online on this topic?
I am seeing Twitter being used as a resource for undocumented immigrants. Specific advice, just scrolling through Twitter right now, I can see, I'm quoting here, if you are raided or if you spot ICE activity, then there are to-dos that you can do if you're in that situation. Here are your rights as an undocumented immigrant. Remain silent, speak to a lawyer, make a call if you're arrested. What's fascinating is that at ICE.gov, is also in the mix of this conversation. So you'll see people having conversations about, perhaps in New York, don't get on this train. People are checking papers. Don't do this. Hmm. People are checking papers. So there's a sense of rumour and panic going around. And at IceGov wanted to stop the panic. This is what they tweeted out recently. Reports of ICE checkpoints indiscriminately for raids and sweeps in cities such as San Fran and Atlanta are false, dangerous, and irresponsible. So that's at IceGov in the conversation too.
And at IceGov, I assume that's the official ICE Twitter account.
Absolutely.
Okay. One more thing, Femi. The Oscars are coming up on Sunday and Google has released the most popular Oscar searches. What are people looking at and does this tell us who might win?
All right. I'm not going to promise you it's going to tell you who's going to win if you're having your little bets coming up for your Oscar party. But this is these are the biggest trends here. Most searched actor in a leading role coming in at number one, we have Ryan Gosling from La La Land. Casey Affleck is number two and Viggo Mortensen is number three for Captain Fantastic. In the most searched actress in a leading role, we have Emma Stone in La La Land, Meryl Streep, Florence Foster Jenkins, number two, and number three, Ruth Negga in Loving. And then finally, most searched Best Picture nominee, La La Land. We're getting a theme going on
yeah,
here.
Yeah, really.
And number one, Moonlight, number two, and Manchester by the Sea, number three. As they say, we will see on Sunday, see how it all pans out. But that's what people are Googling right now.
I think we can pretty safely say it's just going to be La La Land, La La Land, La La Land, La La Land all night. Not that I think that's fair, but that's probably what it's going to be.
But Jeremy, that is the popular vote.
Right.
Who knows what could happen on Sunday?
Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks so much.
You're so very welcome.
Well, there's a lot of talk about people who've migrated from Mexico to the United States. What's talked about less, the cultural connections between the two nations. Mexico's also exported its music, art, and culture. And a festival in El Paso, Texas, called Music Unwound highlights those cultural connections between the U.S. and Mexico with concerts and lectures and more. The festival, which wrapped up earlier this week, took on extra significance given the strained relations between the two countries. Armando Truhl from Here Now contributor WAMU was at the festival and sent us this report.
The theme of this year's Music Unwound Festival was Copeland in Mexico, an exploration of how one of America's iconic composers, Aaron Copland, was influenced by his visits south. Here, the El Paso Symphony Orchestra performs Copland's Salón México during one of three free concerts.
It recalls a moment when Mexico in the 1930s was a cultural mecca.
Joe Horowitz is the director of Music Unwound. He says Copland was just a starting point for a broader look at the impact our southern neighbor has had on American culture.
And people like Steinbeck, Langston Hughes, Eisenstein, Copland, Strand, they're all going to Mexico for the same reason, which is that artists and intellectuals are driving social change, and it amazes the world.
As part of Music Unwound, scholars from the University of Texas at El Paso presented multimedia conferences at the university and at a handful of local high schools, exploring the historic and cultural connections between Mexico and the United States. Dr. Lorenzo Candelaria is an associate provost at the university. He says this year's theme was very timely, given the fact that 80% of El Paso is Hispanic.
It's highlighting the glories of Mexico in the 1930s. And I think it bears reminding that when, especially at a time when a lot of the rhetoric is throwing around what's dangerous about Mexico, what's not acceptable about Mexico from some American point of view.
Tornillo, Texas is a hardscrabble hamlet of roughly 3,000 people, 30 miles south of El Paso, one of a handful of small towns where Unwound workshops were held.
A large majority of our community is Hispanic, and it's important to know that there's Mexican composers and Mexican artists who come out and they become successful.
Jared Flores is 15 and a sophomore. His great-grandparents were the first settlers in Tornillo. He says the festival gave him a new respect for the power of classical music from Mexico.
Something that can excite people, that it's been used to start revolutions, it's been used in wars, and I thought that was very interesting as well.
About 50 miles away, the University of Texas at El Paso String Quartet is rehearsing a piece by Mexican composer Silvestre Revueltas, which they will perform at the festival. They're not in a studio. They're on a stretch of desert a few feet from the U.S.-Mexico border fence. It extends for miles in an east-west direction. The scarred reddish-brown metal bars are as thick as a man's leg and 25 feet high. The student musicians are here for an early morning video shoot. As they perform, a boy and a girl, no older than 6, approach from the Mexican side and peer curiously through the fence. There's a small settlement there, with several dozen homes made of cinder blocks, metal roofs, and wood beams.
Now we have this wall separating countries and cultures.
Violinist Orlando Barajas is from Guadalajara, Mexico.
People from America are on the defensive, and we don't know why.
Cellist Nathan Black comes from Virginia.
On the other side, the children, they come right up to the fence are as friendly as can be. And on our side, there are Border Patrol agents everywhere and people telling us to, you know, not necessarily be here. I find it shocking. Why are we on the defensive when we're simply here to play music and the other side is welcoming it?
The student musicians decide to give the kids an impromptu concert and switch from Revueltas to Mozart. Smiles light up the children's faces as they listen to the quartet play. Once the music stops, the children run away. Violinist Sandra Rivera is from El Salvador.
There is so much hate that is not necessarily what we want, and through music we can change that.
Violinist Eduardo Garcia was born in El Paso.
I thought it was unreal. I didn't know anybody was going to come listen. You know, you think the wall or the border fence is a very distant, remote thing, but there's people living close to it, just feet away from where they're still constructing it. We shouldn't be building walls. We should be building bridges. And
do you think the music does that?
I think the music does do that.
For Here and Now, I'm Armando Drew.
Uber had a bad week. Really bad. It started off with a former engineer charging that the company's culture led to widespread sexual harassment. Then a big competitor accused Uber of stealing its intellectual property. The company, Waymo, the self-driving car business that's part of Google's parent company, Alphabet, charges in a federal lawsuit that a former employee stole some 14,000 files before he left the company. That employee now works at Uber. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News, and he joins us now from New York. Hi, Mike. Happy Friday.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
So pretty rough it at Uber this week. Tell us a little bit more about the allegations in this federal lawsuit.
Right. So the suit alleges that a former Google engineer named Anthony Lewandowski downloaded almost 10 gigabytes of files that included designs for a circuit board, which involves a technology called LIDAR. Now, LIDAR is basically like radar, but it instead of using radio waves, it uses lasers to build basically 3D images of the surrounding landscape. And it has a wide variety of real-world uses, but obviously in this case, both Uber's auto unit and Alphabet's Waymo unit are using it in their self-driving vehicle programs. So that's basically the gist of the allegations.
Big piece of technology there. And if these files were stolen, you know, what was the impact financially? I mean, does the lawsuit talk about that, financial losses for Waymo?
Yeah, the lawsuit contends that self-driving cars right now are basically on the cusp of widespread production in coming years, and that whoever comes to the market in the next few years will set the competitive landscape for the industry. So the winners and losers of this technology could be, you know, cemented very soon. And even the survival of some of these startups depends on who is sort of first to market and first into production with these technologies. And they pointed out that Uber purchased this auto business for $680 million last year to revive its own autonomous driving program. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, contending that these stolen designs were a very large part of that $680 million valuation of the company.
So there's a lot at stake here in this lawsuit. And this employee, however, Mike, worked on self-driving car technology before he got to Google, as I understand it. He designed a self-driving motorcycle in college. I mean, do we know if Alphabet has a strong case here?
You know, just from reading the complaint, it does sound like they have a case if they can prove that these files were stolen in the manner that they describe. Mm. That said, we haven't really heard much out of Uber with their side of the story, except for a brief statement saying that they are taking it seriously and investigating. So, you know, it'll be very interesting to see how they respond and if they, you know, try to defend themselves on this.
Well, also at Uber this week, there's the case of a former female engineer who wrote a blog post, you know, about how she was propositioned for sex by a manager. And when she complained, she was told that manager was a high performer and he won't be punished. Tell us briefly the fallout from that case.
Uber seems to really be taking this matter pretty seriously. They set up a commission that's being led by former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder to investigate the allegations. And they're setting up meetings with female workers to look into it further.
All right. Mike Regan is a senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Did the Trump administration violate longstanding protocols by asking the FBI to publicly deny claims that the Trump campaign communicated with Russian intelligence officials during the election? Can you keep all that straight? That's a question being asked today. And joining us for more details is NPR's Brian Naylor. Brian, let's start with what exactly is happening here. What is the Trump administration saying happened?
Yeah, so this is a little bit complicated, but I think we can walk through this. The Trump administration is admitting that, yes, it did talk to the FBI, and that specifically Chief of Staff Reince Priebus asked top FBI officials, including the director, James Comey, and the deputy director, Andrew McCabe, for help in knocking down a story in the New York Times that the Trump administration was in contact – I'm sorry, that the Trump campaign was in contact with Russian intelligence officials. And both FBI men told Priebus, well, the story is not true. BS, according to a senior administration official who talked to reporters this morning. So according to this official, Priebus said, well, then what can we do about it? And, you know, asking, can you help me out? And McCabe and later Comey both said, well, you know, we can't do anything about this. We don't want to get in the middle of this and this controversy.
And what is the FBI saying about what happened?
Well, we reached out to them, and they're not commenting publicly.
Hmm. Why is contact like this between the White House and the FBI or the campaign – well, the White House and the FBI in this case – considered inappropriate?
Well, so in 2009, then Attorney General Eric Holder wrote a memo saying that the Justice Department, including the FBI, isn't supposed to advise the White House on investigations, only when it's important for the performance of the president's duties and appropriate from a law enforcement perspective, according to that memo. So Democrats are pointing to this memo and saying, well, then what Priebus did was improper. The top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers, said that the White House is simply not permitted to pressure the FBI.
Hmm. And meanwhile, the president took to Twitter this morning to speak out against the FBI, saying they needed to work harder to find the leakers.
Yeah. So you have the president, and, you know, he also spoke at this CPAC conference this morning and attacked the use of anonymous, unnamed sources by reporters. The irony, of course, is that what we learned today about this came from anonymous, unnamed White House officials. And so are some of these leaks. And so it's, you know, it's hard to know exactly how it's affecting the FBI, but it's just the latest Trump broadside against intelligence agencies. And now the FBI, it can't be helpful to morale. And remember, the Justice Department's Inspector General is conducting an investigation into the Bureau's conduct during the Clinton and Trump campaign. So they're kind of getting this from both sides.
Brian Naylor, NPR Washington desk correspondent, thank you.
Thank you.
William Forsythe is one of the most influential choreographers in the world today. He's often credited with changing the nature of modern ballet. After a long career leading the Frankfurt Ballet in Germany, the New York-born Forsythe is back in the U.S. teaching and staging his work. Here and Now's Lynn Menegon met up with him at the Boston Ballet as he prepared for the North American premiere of one of his earliest groundbreaking productions.
All together. 6, 7, and... Okay, no. This is too stopped.
67-year-old William Forsythe doesn't look like a ballet superstar. He's slightly built, he wears glasses, but the former dancer is completely at home in Boston Ballet's rehearsal studio, wearing socks as he shows the dancers how to move. Forsyth is known for deconstructing a dance tradition that goes back five centuries. And there are times when he gets very theoretical about it.
You have to vector it into space with very differentiated dynamics.
Other times, he sounds more down to earth.
It's theater. We're in showbiz.
Forsyth created this ballet, called Artifact, in 1984, when he had some free time in Frankfurt.
Artifact was the first ballet I made for the Frankfurt Ballet, and I had 3 weeks to make it, and I've been fixing it ever since.
He's been fixing it so much that for Boston Ballet, he's calling this production Artifact 2017.
And we're ready.
Artifact 2017 epitomizes what is groundbreaking about Forsyth's work. It's a two-hour spectacle with 68 dancers on stage. There are two speaking parts, which is unusual for a ballet. There's the woman in historical dress. She speaks, and she looks like Marie Antoinette. So does the man with the megaphone.
Step outside.
That's a riddle of sorts from the man with the megaphone, because in ballet, a pirouette is a step that can turn to the outside. But his words also hold deeper meaning, which Forsyth leaves up to the audience to interpret. And there are other surprises. Stage lights turn off, and the curtain drops down repeatedly in the middle of a scene. So there's a lot to coordinate in rehearsal.
Okay, so Raina, five in, Margot, and...
For all these breaks with tradition, Forsyth calls Artifact his ode to classical ballet.
I wanted something that was like a story ballet.
Like Swan Lake, but without the plot. Those kinds of twists have enraged some critics. They say Forsyth took the ballet out of Frankfurt Ballet when he ran it. One even called him the Antichrist of ballet, which makes Forsyth laugh.
I mean, really, it's like, it's okay, right? I mean, at least there's a something going on. Obviously, something's been, disturbed, you know. I think we all love the same thing. Those same critics love exactly what I love. Everyone wants to love it their own way.
And his dancers love him. Here's second soloist Lauren Herfindahl.
Working with Forsyth is really an experience like no other. This ballet is everything from classical to extreme, and it's been really, really interesting to work with. The other day he was saying there's a big girls group section, and he said, "You are representing the women of the past. You're showing how it can be done now."
Two of Herfindahl's fellow dancers, Matthew Slattery and Ji Young Che, are also challenged by the choreographer's technique. They're struggling with a moment in the show where Ji Young does a pirouette while holding one leg to her ear.
Yeah. Keep going.
There you go.
Yeah.
Let yourself stay with where you are. There you go. Yes.
Sorry.
Dana Kasperson is helping them. She's married to Forsyth, and in this show, she's playing the woman in historical dress, the one who looks like Marie Antoinette. I asked her, how important is it to work out these types of moves?
It's everything. It's the heart of ballet. What is this kind of gorgeous, geometric relationship of dynamic that happens between people? And if you don't have that kind of connection, then all you have is a bunch of steps and nobody cares. Because choreography, as Bill has often said, is a vehicle for the desire to dance. So choreography by itself doesn't really matter, but it matters when it can become a vehicle through which dancers can emerge and can live and can express.
And it's an expression beyond words.
Dancing is a kind of experience that happens without language. You can try to describe it through language, but it's an inadequate description.
And that's what drives Forsyth's work. You can hear it when he works with his dancers.
Okay, so you don't want to be good, and you don't want to be even great, yeah? You want to have people actually at a loss for language, yeah? They don't know how to describe, and that's when dance is really working, when it kind of actually makes language not useful.
That's right, Deshaun. That's the idea. Right.
For Here and Now, I'm Lynn Menigon.
And flying cars might still seem a long way off for most Americans, but according to government officials in Dubai, large one-passenger drones could be taxiing people around that city as early as this July. The drones are made by a Chinese company and can carry a person under 220 pounds for about 30 miles. They were unveiled at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas last year. And for more, we're joined by Leslie Josephs, transportation reporter at Quartz. Hi, Leslie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And tell us more about these drones and how they work.
So these are battery-powered drones. The company that makes them, it's called Ehong. It's a Chinese startup. And the drones that we're talking about, it's a four-legged, it looks almost like a spider with half legs, and with eight propellers. And they fly around. Apparently.
And they fly around. And could they really be flying around with humans as soon as July in Dubai?
That's what Dubai wants. It's kind of unusual for Dubai, and you think of cheap gasoline, and Dubai is one of those places where they pay next to nothing for gasoline. But the government there is very keen on finding alternative forms of transportation other than cars, which have been clogging the city for years.
And the company that you mentioned was going to start testing these last year in the U.S., but that has been delayed.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that they need to do. It's very slow going, and they have reached an agreement with the local government authorities in Nevada to do these tests, but there's more to be done. The company has told us that they have already flown them with passengers in China, or test passengers, humans. This isn't something that we're going to be seeing in the skies above the U.S. anytime soon in a commercial sense.
What about the safety risks?
Well, there are many, and that's kind of part of the worry. There was an engineering group that put out not so much a warning, but told people to take this with a little bit of grain of salt because you can attach a motor to pretty much anything. But the problem is there are so many safety risks associated with flying in general, and this is something that's pretty much untested. How does this drone handle something like a bird strike?
Right.
How does it handle something like a malfunction of its software? And those are things that we really don't know. So getting the thing to go, I mean, we've pretty much mastered that as a civilization, just how much that would how that would work in practicality is a bit of an unknown and a scary one.
And occasionally there might be, you know, buildings in the way, especially in a place like Dubai.
Yeah, there might be buildings in the way. And then there's also the risk of hacking. And this is something, the way it works is that there's a touch screen, pretty much no different than an ATM. But instead of typing the amount of money that you want, you're typing in some coordinates. And does that mean as the crow flies, or what if there's an obstacle in the way? And Dubai, we know how they like to build. So how does that really affect your GPS and what kind of routes are you going to be taking, especially when you're sharing the sky with other drones?
Do we have any sense of how much it would cost to take one of these things?
I'm not sure exactly how much it would cost just yet. It's a bit of a promise that they're going to start putting these into production. But with technology, the more of them you have, the cheaper it gets.
Are they environmentally friendly?
They are battery powered. And the thing with battery powered, and this goes for cars as well, it depends on what your source of energy is. So if you're in China and you have a power grid that's powered by coal and then you're electrically charging something, I mean, that might not be as environmentally friendly if you're using other sources like hydropower. But when you're in a clogged city, I mean, I think of Dubai, you think of LA, the first scene of La La Land would be quite different with drones. I think that they want to improve air quality. That's part of the push as well. And they're looking for cleaner sources of energy, even in a place that does have very cheap fossil fuels.
It does look right out of the Jetsons, I must say.
It does.
And I wonder, how long do you think it's going to be until we do live in a world like that?
Right. I mean, technology, you hear these crazy ideas and they often happen sooner than you think. Dubai is doing a lot of other things that we might consider futuristic, but you and I could be having a conversation in 6 months when they are not. They're going to be looking at feasibility of Hyperloop, and the same thing is happening in Abu Dhabi. They already have driverless trains and things like that. So it really depends on what are the safety measures? How do the tests play out? What are the downfalls when they actually go through and try these things in real life?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Hyperloop, because that's another project that sounds really futuristic and so far still is really futuristic because it hasn't come together yet.
Yeah, it's very easy to apply pen to paper and create a feasibility study. So Dubai seems keen on moving forward with it and seeing what are the chances that people are going to be moving pretty much at the same speed of an airplane between Abu Dhabi and Dubai. But building these things, it's another matter. And this is a country that's also has dealt with a falling oil prices. We don't know what their budget's going to be. To link Dubai and Abu Dhabi could be something like $6 billion plus. So money is a factor. Red tape is a factor. Dubai has a little bit of less red tape than maybe the United States does in terms of getting these sorts of things done. But it's unclear. It could happen sooner than we think. But when you're in testing phases and you see a lot of safety risks, that's something that no government really wants to move forward with too fast.
That's Leslie Josephs, who's a transportation reporter at Quartz. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.
Meet George Jetson.